McLean Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Well, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. With potential for being a really beautiful day, a potential for really working in the yard. I hope you get a chance to do that. Hope you get a chance to enjoy the world around you. We got lots to talk about. But, you know, I will tell you, and I just have to be honest with you right up front, that it's hard for me to think about anything else except Ukraine. I keep coming back to it. I keep coming back to what's happening there. I keep coming back to the terror that is being unleashed on Ukraine. And everything else seems to pale in comparison. And I just think we have to give some time to think about that and acknowledge that. Our world does go on. We need to figure out how best to live when things like Ukraine are done. But it needs time. It needs time to think about this and to think about how we keep this from happening again and again and again. Wow, what an incredible place. What an incredible thing that's happening there. And just, I'm trying to get around it. Listen, I do want to talk about your garden. And we're going to do that. I know that a lot of you probably had some damage that you're beginning to assess now. Feel free to call me. And let's talk about it. Let's talk about what it means. Let's talk about what it doesn't mean. It did get cold. We have one more cold spell coming up. I'm pretty sure based on past experience and based on the fact that we now know that springs in Alabama are becoming less dependable. They're becoming more problematic. They're becoming trickier to gauge. Our growing season is actually getting shorter. Alabama and Georgia are the two states where growing seasons are actually getting shorter. That means the span of time between spring and fall frosts is getting narrower by a few days, which is bizarre because the rest of the country, it's the growing season is increasing rapidly in virtually every other state. But in Alabama and Georgia, it's getting shorter. It doesn't surprise me that we're different. We're different in lots of ways, I think. But it's one thing we have to think about. And because it's getting shorter, what that means is, because the nights are getting warmer, winter and summer, what that means is quite simply that we're going to have to think about spring in a different way, because we're getting more frost later in spring and more frost earlier in fall than we did in the past. So we have to be more careful now. And we've talked about that a lot here along the Gulf Coast and in Alabama. We kind of give those warnings. It doesn't mean that we start later. We can't afford to, because summer hasn't changed. And in fact, if anything, summer has gotten earlier. And summer is the end to most of our tomato daydreams. It's just changes things. So we have to get things going before summer gets here. We've got to get them going. We can't do it much later, but it does mean we have to be more careful about spring. There are several ways of doing that. I think it's important for me to talk about them again. Let's think about it real quickly, because some of you have had some frost damage, and some of you are really frustrated with what happened with the tomatoes and with other things. So what are the methods we use to deal with the fact that spring is always unpredictable, but it's spring, we have to have it. If it were predictable, it would be summer, right? That's what I like to say. Summer's pretty predictable on the Gulf Coast. I mean, you don't need to turn in the weather forecast. You know what it's going to do. You know it's going to rain every afternoon. You know the nights are going to be hot. You know the days are going to be warm. That's life on the Gulf Coast. That's life throughout much of Alabama. It's very predictable. But spring, thank goodness, is the time of unpredictability, where the nights are still going to be cool, the days are going to be warm, where you're going to get fronts moving through sort of the playoff of the Gulf and the continent. They're going to keep throwing storms at each other until summer prevails. That's all fine. It is unpredictable, and it's becoming more unpredictable, but here's what we can do. Here's how we deal with it. Protection is very important. Protection for plants, and particularly things that, not so much shrubs and trees, though that's can be important too for certain types of plants, but particularly for things you put in your gardens, vegetable gardens and other things that may be tender. We've talked a lot about that protection and how it works. If you've got any questions, you call me. We'll talk about it. We'll try to talk about it in detail. You know, Jim, I'm thinking about how much you said it would cost to set up all those walls of water in your garden. And Jim made a good point last week that, for example, there are some pretty certain things we can do, like walls of water. But, of course, the cost of losing those tomatoes is pretty high, too. And so it's just an interesting thing to think about, the cost of losing that produce. There's some trade-offs. And maybe you don't protect everything with a wall of water, for example, but you protect some so that at least you come out okay. I do think that there are limits to how early you can start things. I will add this too, based on some conversations we had last week. For example, somebody said my tomatoes were already 3 feet tall. And if your tomatoes are, and that's cool because, boy, that's really cool. If your tomatoes are 3 feet tall the 1st of March, or the middle of March, you're probably getting them started a little too early, and you kind of have to time that because you know that there's going to be some cold spells that are going to come in, and I would say, yeah, go for the tomatoes. Might even be better to prune those tomatoes back, right? If you can't keep them in a wall of waters and they're that big, go ahead and prune them back. But there's a limit to how early you want to start those tomatoes too. Another thought, because spring is going to be unpredictable. And the other thing I'd say is, look, if you want to start things as early in spring as possible, yes. If you want to have tomatoes 3 feet tall in the middle of March, yes. Do it. Give it a shot. It's a good thing. If you want to plant your corn in February, do it. If you want to plant your squash in February just to see what, do it. All that's fine, but just don't throw everything at it. Save some reserves. Save some tomatoes so you can replace, because you know you're taking a chance. You know you're taking a chance. Save some tomatoes that you don't plant out. Start some tomatoes a little bit later. Start some, you got corn seed? Sow it. Corn seed's cheap. Well, it used to be. But it's still pretty cheap. Sow your corn. Sow some corn early. You don't need to sow it all if you're sowing it for yourself. Sow a little bit early just to see what happens. Sow it in middle of February when we get a warm spell just to see. You might get lucky. But you save most of that seed for planting a little bit later. That's another strategy. Go ahead and plant early, but save some reserves. Always save some reserves in terms of tomatoes, in terms of seed. There it is. And then for plants that are permanent, like citrus, like apples, like blueberries, a lot of blueberry damage throughout Georgia and Alabama. Planted in the right spot. In Alabama, you don't need those plants to bloom early. You want them to bloom as late as possible, given our springs. It's very easy to do if you think about it. And there's several ways. Planting locations can make a big difference. Don't plant them where they're going to heat up too much. Plant plant them where they stay a little cooler. We'll talk about how to do that. We'll be back.
To Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Through the window, by the window, that's where I'll be. Come tiptoe through the tulips with me.
Yes, so... Some of you, unfortunately, fortunately or unfortunately, didn't get to hear that annoying piece of music because our streaming is down, and I apologize for that. We're gonna try to do that if you're moving back and forth between our radio broadcast live. So we're gonna try to reboot that. apparently, had a little problem with that here in the past couple of days. We'll try to reboot when we get a chance. What if we, Mary has sent me some great pictures, of whistling ducks, down by her pond. They're coming through. Whistling ducks are one of those ducks that's been sort of expanding its range, here lately. It's not as hunted as much as other ducks. And I think even more importantly, for those ducks is I think they're probably less dependent on prairie potholes, possibly, than other ducks. They're managing to figure it out in a way that other ducks haven't, thanks to our great loss of wetlands, where we lost so many ducks because, in fact, interestingly, I think it's interesting to point out, put the blame where the blame is due in part. The Supreme Court decided that duck habitat isn't wetlands. Go figure. And so weren't protected. It's a Supreme Court ruling we've tried to get around multiple times and we haven't been successful. I know there was legislation that we've tried to pass to fix it, hasn't passed. EPA is trying to come up with a new way of thinking about it so that it's clear that places where ducks breed, which are water and wetland ponds, in prairies, that they are allowed to remain. And you know, it's interesting because it's all happening in the northern tier of states where we're losing so many of those wetlands where ducks are concerned, and it's affecting us. And we're losing wetlands down here, like pitcher plant bogs and other things. And I have a funny feeling we haven't really measured it yet, but I suspect it's affecting people up north as well. It's a really serious problem. But somehow the whistling ducks, Mary, are doing okay. They're actually expanding their range. And I suspect it's probably because they're less dependent on some of the habitats that we lost. Yes, boy, I wish I could. I know I'm getting a lot of messages from folks who are saying they're trying to connect and are asking other technical difficulties. I can't address those folks on the air right now, obviously, because they're not getting it. But if you can get to the radio, that's the way to do it this morning right now. We do not have the streaming service, and I know a lot of you listen that way. And we're going to try to reboot that as soon as we can, see if we can get something going there. Great, some pictures from Greg from his garden. I'm looking at some of the things Greg's got going. Tin barrier, that's interesting. So, you know, Greg is hearing me when I say you need a little bit of protection from that wind. He's got a big piece of tin that he's using to block the wind on that north side and north and west sides, and that can definitely help. And the tin is going to be reflective. That's good too. That mossy growth on the edge of the fig, don't you worry about it at all. It'll be just fine. It's probably some type of, well, I'll have to look. It's a little distant, and it was in the pot, but probably some type of algae that managed to grow there. Maybe a moss, but it was getting some sunlight somehow, maybe through the edge of the pot. Probably some, but probably more like algal growth. It's not going to hurt at all. Greg, one of the things is just don't worry if you want to break up that root ball some when you're planting your fig. Just break it up. It's been in that pot for a while, and it won't hurt. So it'll be really good. So Jim harvested a bunch of turmeric, turmeric. I don't know. What do you think? Help me out, folks. You tell me how you want to pronounce it. So he's got one plant. He's got up to 12. You know, it's really we don't think enough about what herbs really work well along the Gulf Coast. And if I had to say, and then throughout Alabama. You know, rosemary does fine. Basil can do great but you talk to me before you buy your basil. Let's talk about it, because we had some problems with basil last year. I know some people are starting it already. If you're thinking about basil, call me. Let's talk about it, because you want to pick some of the new varieties of basil. And I'll tell you about it. A lot of people who said they had problems with bugs eating their basil, it wasn't bugs. I'm just talked to John Olive about it. We, you know, John's got to be a little less certain about it than I am, but we're both pretty sure that that what people are looking at is not bug damage. I'm increasingly certain that what people have been talking about with problems with their basil was not bug damage, but was in fact basil downy mildew. And with this downy mildew that's relatively new to basil, it can look pretty bad. Looks like something's infecting the leaves on the bottom, and then the leaves start getting brown and withered, and they get little holes in them. There's a way to fix that. There's an easy way to fix that. And in fact, it's by growing the right type of basil. And call me, because it makes a big difference. It makes a big difference. And I have found that the good thing about some of the new types of basil, which are natural hybrids, they're really cool. They're natural hybrids between a couple of varieties of basil, is that I actually like them better. Not just that they're more disease resistant, but that they are actually more productive. They last longer. They don't go to seed. They don't get bitter. They're really incredible, some of these new varieties of basil. So call me about that. So basil's great too. But, that's all a long way to say there's some other herbs that we do well. But, boy, if you were going to name a couple of herbs that do really well along the Gulf Coast and throughout Alabama, you'd say ginger. And ginger, folks, is an herb. And it's one you can grow. And you can get plenty of it. And turmeric, which is a type of ginger, looks very similar to ginger. Probably couldn't distinguish it easily if you saw them the two of them together. Turmeric is really easy to grow, too. Really easy to grow. And they're both really good in the kitchen. Really good in the kitchen. All right. And Jim's got a whole mess of it there on the kitchen counter. Looks really good. So somehow we're on this and Sean sends me a question too about herbs. And one is tulsi or holy basil. Holy basil and tulsi basil are used frequently in lots of cuisines. They're not my favorite. At least I haven't found a way that I enjoy using them. But don't take my word for it, because there are a lot of people who do use them. There are a lot more people who do use them than people who know about them and don't use them. It is a very popular herb around the world and widely used. And it can be very good. There's a basil that was bred, Mithrani basil, I think that's the name of it. I'm doing this out of a file drawer somewhere in my head. Is, I believe, one of the basils that was used in the new breeding programs to produce the basils that are resistant to downy mildew. And it's really good in and of itself. I found it really delicious on chicken. It's a little stronger tasting. A little bit more licorice tasting, but not overtly. It's more like a summer savory kind of flavor. Really delicious. We're gonna be back. Give us a call 251-343-0106.
Sitting on the front porch, cooling in the shed, singing every song the radio played. Waiting for the Alabama sun to go down to red dirt girls in a red dirt town, me and Lillian. Just across the line in a little southeast of Meridian.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yeah, welcome back. So, I hope we're back on with our streaming. Some folks might want to check to make sure. I've got too many things open for me to tell. But if anybody gets a chance, check to see if our streaming's back up. So holy basil, interesting question. A lot of different kinds of basil, and we did get a little distracted with that, but it's a good distraction. I don't use holy basil for cooking, and I don't know how many people do. I'm not going to say it isn't done. I think it's used more as a medicinal. And I'm talking over my head because I don't use it, and I'm not part of cultures that do use it, but it is used as a medicinal. Do medicinals work? Ooh, I'm not going to get into that on this show this morning. I think that probably some of them do. I think that we have a very, very poor way of gauging which ones do and which ones don't, and figuring out under what situations they work and don't work, and we sometimes take information that's scanty information and draw too much from it. So I'm not going to make a great case for medicinals, because the honest to goodness truth is we just don't know. And you get to believe whatever you want to believe, and sometimes you just have to, because we don't have enough information. One of the things that a lot of herbs that we use medicinally don't have going for them is the fact that they can't be trademarked in a way. It's hard for people with a lot of money to actually go through the process of legitimately testing whether these are useful or not. Sometimes it's done, and often when it is done, the results come back poorly. They don't reflect well on the herb, and you could argue that there are many reasons for that. One, it maybe the tests aren't long-term enough, maybe they aren't conducted correctly, but it becomes expensive for people who are selling herbs to continue to use those tests, so they fall back on, well, you just got to kind of believe us. And that's dangerous, too. So it's a difficult thing. That's why you don't hear me talking a lot about medicinal herbs. It's not that I'm not going to make a case that they don't work. I just don't have enough information that they do. And neither do most of us. And so it's dangerous. I would definitely be careful about treating conditions for which we have better treatments. I would be careful about using herbs for that. Just like I think I wouldn't use horsewormers for anything other than horseworming and cowworming. There it is. We now have, finally, we got enough commotion about that we've had some studies that have come out that said, you know, horsewormers make pretty good horsewormers. And probably not as much else. So just to think about that. I shouldn't have said that, should I? But there it is. That's the truth. That's why I don't talk about herbs more, because there's a lot of nonsense out there. And I'm not sure that when it comes to medicinals, they're great. But for cooking, they're really good. And I do think that eating herbs is good for you in the long run. Even though it might not address specific ailments, it's probably good for you in the long run. I think probably eating peppers is really good for you. And just like eating tomatoes is probably really good for you. And beans, I think there's a lot of evidence that beans are really great. That's a long-term benefit from keeping your system running. And I think probably herbs like rosemary and ginger, I think there's some good evidence that in the long run, eating ginger is probably good for you. But for curing specific ailments, I don't know. Maybe not so much. Maybe not so much. I hope folks are getting their internet connections now. Let me talk a little bit this morning. I was gonna do it anyway, and it's a thinking that I've been doing lately, and you know that sometimes shows up on the shows when I've been thinking too much. And one of the things I've been thinking about are allergies. I could have done a whole show on allergies. It's really cool, because this is the time of year for allergies, right? And a lot of people are suffering, and I think about them a lot. I think about that suffering. I think about how hard allergies are, and I want to think about, well, how do I really begin to address it? And I know people who have allergies, they want it fixed, boy. They want it fixed. So how do you do that? How do you deal with allergies? Well, one of the ways we've dealt with it is to take a plant-by-plant, sort of a plant-by-plant tactic to get rid of allergies. So for a long time we said, okay, you got allergies, it's goldenrod. Well, goodness gracious, of course it wasn't goldenrod. It was never goldenrod. It couldn't be goldenrod. Nobody who has allergies because of goldenrod unless they snort goldenrod. And I mean, I'm talking about taking the pollen off the plant and snorting it up your nose. I don't mean to be that way about it, but that's how blunt I need to be. You cannot get goldenrod pollen up your nose because it's so heavy. It's designed to be carried by bees and by wasps and by butterflies, by whatever else visits. That's why it's colorful. That's why the plants are colorful. So it was never goldenrod. And so that's it. And then people say, oh, it's the pine pollen. Well, pine pollen is noted among trees for being some of the least allergenic pollen out there. That's right. You can see the pine pollen. You can see it. It's very visible. You can see it falling from the trees. But in some reason, some ways, that's a good evidence for why it's not pine pollen causing the problems. Pine pollen's very heavy. It's also hyperallergenic. It developed in times before the sophisticated chemistry that oaks developed with their pollen. Before all that, it's not part of the pine pollen. So most people, that's why Fairhope, that's why Spring Hill was such a desirable place to live in so many ways for people who had allergies. So people who were having respiratory problems came to places like Citronelle. Citronelle was a famous sanatorium. For people who had asthma problems and respiratory problems, because the pine trees were considered hypoallergenic, they didn't cause problems. So why did we do this? Because I guess we're visual folks. That's the first thing with pollen we need to say, and then we're going to come back and talk a little bit more about it. Our first problem is that we're very visual, and we see the pollen, and we say, "Ooh, that's got to be it. Pollen's causing my allergies. That's what's it." Or because we see the flowers, and we see the goldenrod blooming, and we say, "Oh, well, that's pretty." We may not see the pollen. You don't see the pollen because only the bees see it. Or you can see it on the hips of the bees, right, when they're carrying it from plant to plant. But somebody's going to say bees don't have hips, but they do sort of. And they're carrying it from plant to plant, right? You see, that's the only place you're going to see that pollen. So things that are insect-pollinated, they don't give you allergies. Pines don't give you allergies, but you see them, and you think, oh. So with pines, as it turns out, pines were, people were getting allergies when pines shed pollen. But what was the real problem? The problem was oak pollen. Oak is probably the number one source of pollen misery in Alabama. And it makes sense because Alabama is the center of oak diversity. So you betcha. And most of our cities have tons of oak trees. I mean, it's hard to avoid an oak tree, right? You got live oaks, you got water oaks coming up like weeds. We got all southern red oaks. I mean, there's always an oak nearby, even when there aren't pines. And one of the funny things is, because we had such a misunderstanding of what was causing our allergies, many people deliberately cut down their pines because they thought they were causing the allergies, and they planted them with oaks. And you know what? Fairhope, Citronelle, Mobile, Spring Hill, they lost their reputation as places where people who had allergies would go. And they did have that reputation. It was a retreat for people with allergies because of the pine trees. And we replaced them with oaks. You see the problem? You see the problem if you don't think about carefully about what's causing your problem. If you just go after it because you say, I'm tired of this. I want it done. And you don't think about what you're doing, and you don't think about what's the problem source. So I got another little thing here, and it's the goldenrod thing. And we're going to come back to it.
Go on, people, day to have you ever seen me dead? Go on, people, day to why wake up one morning, take your legs off of mine? While I'm gone, baby, don't you wanna go? While I'm gone, back no more.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Rain on my face. Hasn't stopped raining for days.
Yeah, welcome back. Let's go. Let's get back to the subject of allergies. I'm pumped up about it. I got the snivels too. Listen, here, what are we going to do about our allergies, right? We talked a little bit about it. We talk about how we make these huge mistakes, like thinking that pine trees were the source of our allergies, when in fact they were hypoallergenic. They were the least allergenic, perhaps, of all the trees you could possibly have in your yard, with the exceptions of the ones that are insect pollinated. But of most of the large trees you could have in your yard, they were the least allergenic, certainly less allergenic than oaks, than maples, than, you know what another really big allergy producing tree is that we don't think about? Much worse than, probably as bad as oaks, and really serious, because it really, a lot of people are sensitized to the pollen. Pecans. Boom. There it is. You know, we don't think about those trees as much because their flowers aren't showy. But that means, because their flowers aren't showy, Bruce said he was eating his breakfast underneath. Barry said he was eating his breakfast underneath an oak tree that's blooming in his yard. Those tassels, those are male tassels. They're coming out before the female flowers. They always do. The female flowers are very indescript. They're sort of embedded on the twigs. They're really hard to see. The male flowers are tassels that are not pretty. They're just tassels. Tossels, as they say out in the Midwest. And tassels, but that's where the pollen's coming from, but you don't notice it because it's not like it's a magnolia. It's not like a big flower that's staring you in your face. If it's a big flower staring you in the face, like a magnolia, the pollen is being carried by insects. In the case of magnolias, beetles. Or if it's a flowering tree like a cherry or an apple or a pear, the pollen's going to be generally carried by insects, right? That's the way it works, because they're showy. That's why they're showy. So there it is, pecans, oaks, mulberries. Mulberries are terrible at causing allergies. Mulberries, hazelnuts, elms, ash trees, lawn grasses. Cedars are huge. A lot of those in the cupressus group, the cupressaceae, never mind, I won't say that out loud again. A lot of those are very big sources of pollen, right? They're huge sources of pollen. And we forget about them because their flowers aren't showy, and we tend to go with other things. So there's the goldenrod. There's the goldenrod thing. And so people said, well, it's goldenrod. I said, well, of course it's not goldenrod, because goldenrod's showy and the pollen's too heavy, and nobody gets allergies as a result of goldenrod. It's ragweed. And I said, ragweed, we're going to blame it on ragweed. But you know what? There's no question a lot of people are sensitized to ragweed. And everybody says, oh, we can't have it at all. We got to get rid of ragweed. But you know what? Ragweed compared to something like olives, 50% of people in Spain and Italy where olives are grown are highly sensitized, 50% or more, are highly sensitized to olive pollen, right? Highly sensitized to olive pollen. But they don't stop growing olives. Ragweed, sensitization of the population to ragweed is about, oh, I don't know, the worst estimates I've seen are 25%. It's probably closer to 15%. People suffer from ragweed. There's no question. It is an important allergen. It's it's less important than oaks because the season is so narrow. It's a very narrow season. It's less important than the spring allergies because it only occurs in fall for a narrow season. And yet ragweed gets all the blame. We're very irrational about it. And then we try to do things like getting rid of the things that cause us pollen. And there's a funny story here. It's a really funny story. And we're going to have to, may have to wait till after the, if you can hold on for just a little while and come back after a break, I'm going to try to finish this up. And Thomas, here was a funny story. We decided that, and I've talked to lots of people in Mobile who decided that we don't want trees that produce fruits in our cities. Because the fruits might stain our pristine concrete. You know, there's nothing like getting nature on your concrete, right? Who wants nature on their concrete? Concrete should be free of nature. So we in our cities, when we planted trees, we only could plant trees that didn't attract birds, that didn't have fruits, right? And so that meant that when we had mulberry trees, which are incredibly potent sources of pollen, that meant that they only planted male mulberries. Males produce pollen. Females don't produce pollen. So in our cities, because we decided we didn't want any fruits staining our concrete, we created a huge pollen issue by planting only male mulberries. We don't think about this very well. We don't think about it very well. And I don't think we can take this sort of plant-by-plant approach to allergies, because there are way too many plants that cause allergies. And most of them are the plants that we love. Things like olive, things like cereal grasses, things like lawn grasses, they're all producing pollen. Now, please believe me, Bermuda and Bahia grasses are big sources of pollen. And if you want to get rid of them because of the pollen, that's fine with me, because Bermuda and Bahia are just pure annoyances as far as I'm concerned. We would all be better without them. But if you think you're going to solve your pollen problems because you're doing that, you're not. It's not going to solve our allergies. That's one thing we ought to talk about. Well, any rate, I did it. Got it all out. I'm thinking a lot about this. I'm thinking about new ways to think about it. And you know what I'm thinking about? I'm thinking about ragweed. I'm going to resurrect ragweed as a really important plant. And we'll talk about why. Oh, you think I'm crazy, don't you? But it's really important. We'll be back. Folks, thanks for holding on. We're going to be right back after this break. Give us a call, 251-343-0106. Sugar Magnolia, blossoms grow, that's all that you have, don't care.
Saw my baby down by the river.
Who she had to come up soon for care.
Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. We got a radio show. And we got folks listening. The streaming is back, I think. Alicia gave me a thumbs up anyway. I think it's all back. Yeah, so we're good. We're working really well. We had a bunch of callers here at the last part of our section. I got excited about allergies, and I wanted to finish that discussion. But, Wade, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
So sorry for the delay. Tell me what you got with the citrus.
I ordered some from, I believe it was a mandarin, and another type of orange, and I had them for about 2 months. And then I got a notice that the FDA or not the USDA, had found citrus canker in a couple of the suppliers' plants. So they told me to hang on to it. Nobody ever got to me, so I called them, and they ended up, they were in Foley. And they came over and took those, but they looked at the picture I'd sent you, and they couldn't tell what it was. It had some leaf miner damage in that tree, but I couldn't tell if it was the canker like they're talking about. I didn't know if you might know the early signs of it. I was afraid
so
from those trees to the other, to my other citrus is what I was worried about.
Yeah, you do want to watch. And this is a citrus canker is a big deal, folks. It's one of the two big deals that could really affect us. I think citrus canker is the least bad. If we get green dragon, it's going to be really bad.
That's bad.
But citrus greening. But citrus, you know, wait, I looked at your pictures, and I assume you sent me those pictures. Clearly leaf miner damage can interact with cankers, but not, you know, I'm not going to diagnose it based on that picture. My first instinct is, no, I don't think it is canker. And there's a couple of reasons why I don't think it is, but you don't have the tree anymore, right?
I do. It's in the front yard. I don't have the two that I ordered, but this is a four-year old tree, and it wasn't anywhere near those two that they suspected. I had those in the back.
Yeah.
They were away from everything, actually. Luckily, I never put them in the ground. I was waiting for spring, and I mean they were still in the container.
Well, and the folks who came to your yard couldn't tell. Did they look at those leaves to see if there was damage?
They did. They just they were hesitant to say anything. They said that I might get a call, and some other guys might come out in a couple months. But yeah, I can understand why they did, because you know they said it's hard to diagnose it at an early stage. So
right. Well, it's the the pustules. If you see these pustules, if you see the. They're kind of like warty brown bumps that'll show up on the leaves and on the fruit.
On the leaves. Okay.
That's going to be typical. We want to stop it as soon as we can, and you want to stop it before those pustules get too big, because that does spread it pretty good as well. And then things like leaf miners, when you have leaf miner damage, it allows for lots of locations where the canker can enter into the tree. I mean, canker seems to need a hole. It seems to need a place where it can get in. So a lot of times you'll see it around where you get the leaf miners on citrus. Though leaf miners in general aren't a problem, but with citrus canker it can be. So,
yeah,
I don't know. I would, the only thing I can tell you is if you are concerned, make sure that the cooperative extension folks know that you're still concerned about that tree. But I can't. Usually there's usually a bright yellow ring. That's not a certain thing, but usually you'd see a bright yellow ring around those holes. I don't see that, nor do I see the sort of water-soaked areas that are typical around those leaves. And that doesn't mean you don't have it. It just means that if you do, I can't. There's nothing about that spot that makes me certain that that's what it is. So have it checked out.
It's never fruit. I mean, it flowered last year. But I don't. They said sometimes it takes 6-7 years for those to flower.
Yeah, so how old is the tree?
How old is that pomelo? You remember? Three years, I think. Maybe three. It's about 6 feet.
Oh,
tall.
It's a pomelo. Yeah. You're going to have a real hard time with that. It is not a hardy tree. So if it never fruited, what it would prove is that you were going to have a real hard time with pomelo. It's just not that hardy here.
Is that one of those that you should really have two, or?
No. It's just that it's not cold hardy. The blooms are very susceptible to cold damage. The buds are very susceptible to cold damage, so it may not even flower.
Yeah, north side of the house too.
It's a tough one. It's a tough one. And, you know, I would say if you were worried about it at all and you wanted to make sure your other citrus weren't affected, I'd say get it out of there. Before in case it were, because it's, I think the chances of you're ever getting a good crop out of that citrus are not good. I mean, what we do well are satsumas, clementines, some oranges like Hamlin orange and Louisiana sweets. We do really well. Navel's kind of okay. People even do grapefruit, and lemons, Meyer's lemons, we do okay. Limes, we do terribly unless in pots. But pomelo, no.
Well, no. Okay. That makes sense. Hey, I just sent you another picture of a plumero. Is that what it's called? The Hawaiian plant? That they make the lays out of?
Yeah.
I don't know if you get
plumerium?
What kind of care do they need? Just keep them out of the cold and...
Yes. You do want to keep them. Some varieties go dormant during the winter. They like a little bit of a drying out period. I don't know which varieties you have. Some of them like to be evergreen during the winter.
This one had leaves on it when I got it. My uncle got it when it was about a foot long, and it's 6 feet tall now.
How does he care for it? Does he put it in the garage? What does he do with it during winter?
He kept it inside when it got cold, but he kept it on the patio when it was warm. He never brought it in for an extended period of time.
Yeah, so I would follow his lead on that. You're not going to be able to leave it outside once it gets down to about 40 degrees. So bring it inside. And it'll probably survive down to around 36, 32 maybe. Yeah. And if it's a deciduous type that tends to go dormant, it might survive a little bit colder. But I would, you're going to have to move it in and out just like he did. That's a lot of the year it can stay outside and should stay outside, and it'll do much better for it.
Okay. Well, that's great.
All right, Wade, good to hear from you.
I really appreciate your time, man. Have a good day.
All right, you too. Oh, boy, 1 minute to break. We got lots of things to do. And we got three callers. Let's see. Thomas, let's get you started. Charlie, if we can hold the break just a little bit. Thomas, I'm listening.
All right. A few years ago, I had to transplant a Meyer's lemon at an inopportune time so that Terminex could put the little bait stations down, and it has not survived. It is now only the rootstock. I've been gifted another lemon and was wondering what I need to do to get that old rootstock out of the ground and put the new lemon tree there.
All right. First off, what kind of lemon is it?
It's not a Meyer's this time. I'm not sure the specific type of this one.
Thomas, the climate is not changing nearly fast enough for you to grow that lemon. Meyer's lemons are very different. They're a hybrid between oranges and lemons, and they're a little bit more cold hardy. Regular lemons, if it's not a Meyer's lemon, a regular lemon, you do not want to put it in the ground. The chances of you're getting fruit are just very rare. They are very cold susceptible. Let me recommend that you keep it in a pot.
Okay.
And use it. I had a lemon that I had in a pot for years and years. It was delightful. It was wonderful. And sometimes I got two crops a year because I had it in a pot. And lemons will do that. And that's really nice, isn't it? Whereas the best you could hope for is one crop every 6 or 7 years in your yard. So the tree will probably get killed before you actually get a crop. So don't put it in your yard. There's the simple answer to that.
Okay, and as far as the pot, just keep repotting as it grows a little bit?
That's right. And you know, as about every couple of years, you're going to need to repot. Sometimes you can go 3 years, but every couple of years. And listen, you don't always have to make the pot bigger. As it gets to a certain size and you're comfortable with the size of it, what you do is, let me just say this real quickly, you pull it out of the pot, you shake the dirt off, and you literally slice off the roots all the way around about an inch to 2 inches into the plant. Cut about 6 inches off the bottom, about 2 inches off the sides, all the way around. Repot it. It'll be very vigorous. You want to do that. You can do it right after it flowers is an okay time to do it. It'll be okay to do it. But about every 2 to 3 years you do that once you get it to the right size. But for now, just keep popping up this pot size.
All right, that sounds good, Bill. I appreciate the time.
All right, thank you. Boy, Charlie, we better do this break, don't you think? Great minds, Charlie.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Casey, get your pencil ready. I'm going to answer your question about the herbs when I get a chance here. Casey asked me to list those herbs again that do well on the Gulf Coast. I can't list them all, but I'm going to give a big list. But first, honey, in Robertsdale, and Chris have been very good about holding on. Honey, I'm listening. Tell me what's going on.
Hey, what is blood meal? One of my friends said to put that on my ferns. I've always fertilized my ferns with Miracle-Gro. Should I swap?
No, for a lot of reasons. But no. I would keep using the Miracle-Gro on your ferns. You're used to using it. You know just how much to use. Your ferns are doing okay. They're fine. And blood meal is going to be an entirely different sort of thing. I wouldn't recommend using blood meal in pots, in containers, for a variety of reasons. It would be easy to overuse it. It's going to react slowly. I do use blood meal on occasion in the garden when I need a quick boost of nitrogen. Blood meal is basically what it sounds like. It's basically it's leftover from killing cows and pigs.
Oh, good grief.
Yeah. So it's sort of the leftover stuff that is then when they're bled. And probably has other things in it as well. But it's the result of livestock butchering, and it is very high in nitrogen, and it can be useful. It has some there's some concerns about using it. I don't think they're big concerns, but I don't use a lot of it, and I certainly would not use it in containers for a variety of reasons. That's really simple. I could make it harder, but I'm not. No.
No, that's fine. That's exactly what I wanted to know. No, don't use it.
Yeah.
The next question is wheat straw bales. I lived in Bullitt County, and someone brought me a backhoe full of four-year-old decomposed wheat straw bales that had broken and just said, where do you want your garden? And so they dumped it. Anything I put in it grew. I mean, even a toothpick, I think, was going to grow. It was that good. But the Extension Service just put an article about growing in wheat bales. And I know they work. I know you can do it. You put a little bit of soil in it, Miracle-Gro, and then you put in your plant, and it grows. I mean, they do grow. But this thing, when I had mine in Bullitt County, I never put any fertilizer, nothing, just water. And this one says about wet it and then put some water-soluble nitrogen in it and then put some lime in 10 days. I don't want to have to do all those. Do I have to? Or is that going to make it really grow when it will just
two differences.
Grow by itself?
Two differences that I can see. that might have an effect. The first is that you got very, very rotted bales, which probably, that means the bacteria were already releasing nitrogen into those bales. So because they were so rotted, you were actually getting, it was breaking down, it was already being broken down to the point that it was already releasing nitrogen. So that probably helped. So I wouldn't, if you're getting a fresher wheat straw bale from like last season's harvest, from this year's harvest, they're probably going to need a little bit of nitrogen to help them break down. And blood meal could do it. Miracle-Gro could do it. Cottonseed meal could do it. But you're going to need a little bit because as it breaks down, it's actually going to tie up nitrogen and you could have a problem. The other thing was Bullock County. And if you were living in, were you living on prairie in Bullock County? Was it a heavy clay that you were on?
No, it really wasn't. It really wasn't really that heavy a clay. But when they put down the decomposed bales, they put it so deep that I didn't even have to fool with soil. I mean, you couldn't even find the soil. It was just there.
Right, and that's fine. What I'm saying is that it could make a little bit of difference in that those soils may have helped to interact with the bottom parts of the roots and helped to overcome the nitrogen deficiency. Some of the natural soils in Bullock County are what we call marl, M-A-R-L, blue marl, and they're famous for having lots of available nitrogen in them, that could have helped. You wouldn't see the same thing here. But the short is, you want the short answer again, and I'm going to give you the short answer. Yeah, you're probably going to have to add lime, and you're probably going to want to add. You're probably going to want to add a little bit of Miracle-Gro, just like you do to your ferns.
Now they said a certain kind of lime. Let me spell it for you: D-O-L-O-M-I-T-I. Lime.
Dolomitic lime. Okay. And dolomitic lime is it's the common lime. It's the most typical lime. Don't use granulated lime. Just use powdered dolomitic lime, regular old lime. What dolomitic lime means is that there's a balance of calcium and magnesium, and that's what you want. You'll need a little magnesium. So dolomitic lime is the perfect thing. It's the least fancy lime. Now, if you go to a fancy pantsy store, they're going to sell you some kind of crazy lime. Just go to Robertsdale.
I'm going to a feed and seed in Bay Minette next to the railroad tracks.
There you go.
Just the hometown good old stuff, and they tell you anything you need to know. But I figure you're the expert, so I'll come to you.
Yeah,
first.
You just tell them you want dolomitic, and now you know how to say it. You can say it out loud proudly. Dolomitic.
Okay. Dolomitic. I want
limestone with dolomite in it. I want dolomite limestone, dolomitic limestone, which means it's a balance of magnesium and calcium, and they'll know what you're talking about, and they'll get it to you.
Okay. And you don't know, and everybody doesn't know how wonderful it is to walk outside your door and pick your fresh greens and broccoli and tomatoes and kale and cook them.
Isn't that neat? Isn't that good?
This is wonderful. And for little old people, a bale, you don't have to crunch all over. You just go out and pick.
Yeah. Of course, it makes the tomatoes a little bit higher, but they're those straw bales, they can work well.
Okay.
It's all about organic matter. Yep. Good. Thanks for calling, honey. Ah, goodness gracious. Chris, if you can just hold on, because I don't think we're going to have time to answer your question before I have to take another break. That's the way it is. What else have I missed besides the stuffed pork loin that Jim served last night and accidentally sent a picture of to me? Jim, you did that on purpose. I just feel like you did that on purpose. But he's also got a crinum blooming, which is awful nice. Awful nice to see. David's got his tomatoes planted working on squash, beans, and peppers. And the melaton vines are jumping like crazy. One more cold spell, folks. I think one more cold spell. David, watch this one coming up probably in about another 8 days, 8 to 10 days. Just watch it. Just be careful. We'll be back.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Samson seems sort of sweaty.
The jasmine is smooth. Okay, listen, Mary and KC and some other folks are waiting with a pencil on herbs, and I've got my pencil out. I'm trying to make my list, trying to make sure I got everything figured out. Well, let me write one more down here right quickly. Oh yeah, I got it. So we're gonna be back to that, but Chris has been waiting patiently. Chris, I'm listening. Tell me what's going on.
Good morning, Bill. Thank you for my call, and thank you for our entire area. I've enjoyed listening to you for years. I'm Chris out of Daphne. Been over there in Lake Forest for the last 30-something years. Over in Elsinore in a very, very wet area. My question is, what type of plants could I put in cypress to help remove water that's standing in many areas?
Well, you know, it's probably that was probably a pitcher plant bog, which
is now... actually it used to be a pasture, a cattle pasture, but yeah, it's got natural springs. I put in the other day. And within 10 feet, 2 feet down, I had 4 natural springs bubbling out.
Yeah, that was so there was life before cattle pastures. And it was before the cattle, it was probably a pitcher plant bog. So it helps me to understand what's going on there. It's going to be very hard to fix that, and I'll just tell you. And there's a it's a great reason not to build near one if you can help it. What's happened is this is a clay lens. It's probably very close to the surface. The water is not able to go beyond that, and it's emerging there with these springs. I doubt you'll ever be able to completely absorb all the excess moisture of those springs.
How can I complement it then?
Yeah. So, well, certainly cypress will survive in it, and trees will help to soak up some of that excess moisture. It's just that you won't be able to grow much underneath it. But trees will absorb a lot of it. Slash pines will do very well in that kind of habitat. At some point, as you get interested in it, if we see any remnants of pitcher plants, we might try to encourage that and see what we can do. How many acres do you have?
It's probably right at 2 acres. And I know Weeks Bay has got their plant sale, I think sometime in March. And so I plan to spend some time down there and I understand one of the master gardeners, Fred Nation, he's like a bog plant expert, so I'm hoping to get him out to take a look at things as well.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, getting it back to being a pitcher plant bog after having been a cattle farm for a long time will take a little bit of thinking, but it's quite possible that it could work very well. So if you can get Fred out, that would be a big help. He'll probably be able to help you a lot there. And start small. Don't feel like you have to do the whole thing at once.
Now it's like I've got a house floating on a monolithic pad in the middle of an island after Thursday's rains. So now it's a matter of trying to get at least that stabilized. Suggestions there?
What's that?
Well, the house is basically floating on a monolithic pad in the middle of an island.
Right.
And so should I just go ahead and at least sprinkle seasonal rye to help stabilize the soil that I brought in?
Yeah, except that rye is now going to go dormant because it's getting so warm. So you have some loose soil that needs to be stabilized?
Well, yeah.
How much?
I think it's something in the neighborhood of 200 or 300 cubic yards. Yeah, it's a huge area. And that's why I was hoping to get a bunch of sod out here the other day, and it didn't happen. So half of it's washed into my pond.
Yeah, and that's going to be a big problem, isn't it? Well, it is a problem. I can't tell you it's not. You know what I might do just to get to whole things, particularly since you're pretty well advanced now, is to go ahead and sow something like sorghum, until you can stabilize the areas, particularly in strips, and the sorghum. I'm trying to think if the sorghum's going to survive that excess moisture. It probably would, and don't let it. You don't want to necessarily let it go to seed. You just want to use it to. It's the seed is relatively cheap. You can sow it over a large area. It'll stabilize those soils well enough that that you can then have some time to think about what to do. It's going to look a little odd, but at least it'll help you. Now, the areas closer to your house, you might want to try to go ahead and put in grass.
Right.
But you know, it's building in a wetland causes problems. Not only for nature, but for the people who build there. So
yeah,
it's
you don't have to tell me that. I know.
Yeah. So and thank you for letting us know. And let's try to help out as much as we can. I think sorghum is sorghum, for example, you need something now that does well over summer. And you want an annual that you don't regret and, that becomes a problem later. Peas can do it, but peas don't last very long. And you can't really, you can try things like iron and clay peas. You can mix that with it. And that can help hold, but I think probably sorghum's going to be better. And you'll want to go in and have some way to cut it a couple of times, cut it relatively high, about 8 to 10 inches high, and let it come on again. And you'll begin to build some organic matter there. You won't get a lot of weed growth underneath it, which is great. And then you can, when you're ready for a permanent solution, you can just mow it low. But at this point, it's too late for rye. I think you're going to need to use a summer crop. I use sorghum a lot on wetlands, and it tends to work okay.
Sounds good.
All right.
Well, I thank you again. You're always entertaining. I do appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Chris. Listen, I'm going to talk a little bit about herbs now. And I wonder if I've got my list all figured out. But listen, there's a couple of ways I think about herbs, folks. When I'm thinking about how to do herbs, there are some herbs that will last all year, and rosemary's one. So on the Gulf Coast, rosemary can be very good. You want it in well-drained soil. You don't want it in a pitcher plant bog. You don't want it in a swamp. It needs to be well-drained. You can keep it in a pot pretty well. rosemary lasts all year. It's pretty good for us. It's a great herb that lasts all year. It's an easy one. There are a number of herbs. Get your pencils out. There are a number of herbs that are basically overwintering herbs. Let's call them overwinter herbs on the Gulf Coast. You're not going to hear this when you go up to Michigan. They don't talk about this up there because it ain't the same climate, so they don't talk about herbs in the same way. But we have a number of herbs that are overwintering herbs. If you're ever going to be successful with thyme, T-H-Y-M-E, it's going to be overwinter. It hates summer here. It hates summer. But it can do okay during the winter. And if you buy your thyme in fall, you might be able to have a lot of herbs. Buy it in late summer. Get it going, you know, wherever you can find the thyme. And you may have a lot of thyme over winter. Same is true for sage. I love sage. It's a great to cook with. And, you know, if you can get some sage plants in late summer along the Gulf Coast, it'll do fine. It melts even in North Alabama, sage does. And you kind of have to leave it a lot of summers. If it gets a lot of rain, it just melts. There's no other word for it. But sage does great over winter, particularly along the Gulf Coast. It does great in spring and fall. So those are overwintering herbs. Oregano is sort of the same way. It's a little better. It's a little easier to keep it alive during the summer. It's better to keep it alive in pots. And I'm thinking about all the oreganos that are commonly available, with the exception of Mexican oregano, and I'll come back to that. Cilantro and parsley. Listen, these are two great overwintering herbs. They are easy. They're wonderful. They're great. You never want to start them in spring. You always want to start them in fall. Cilantro goes to seed if you plant it too late, if you plant it in spring. You want to plant it late. It does great. You can have cilantro, pick cilantro all winter long. Cilantro and parsley, overwintering herbs. And then there's the summer herbs like basil. And we can talk a lot about the different kinds of basil. Ginger, turmeric. An herb that I love, we're just beginning to explore things like some of the South American herbs that are so good. Papalo. Papalo and its relatives, I just love papalo. It's a great herb for using along the Gulf Coast. Like cilantro, it's you know, some people say, oh, I can't do it. But, you know, people who love papalo are often people who love cilantro. It's delicious. It's not exactly like cilantro, but it's really good. And then South American pepper is another great herb. And then that's probably all I have time to say because Charlie's going to go into a break right now. Did that help?
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. It's the Gulf Coast Sunday morning. And we got our last little segment here. Boy, I feel like I need to follow up on a couple of things. A lot of people don't like cilantro and won't like papalo as well. I love papalo. I think it's great. I love the flavor of it. Did I mention garlic? It's a great herb as well. We need to think of it as an herb. And you can use the leaves during winter, use the bulbs during spring. Sometimes the leaves may be better. I like the leaves as much as I like the bulbs now. I've come to really appreciate the leaves of garlic. I think I could grow it just for the leaves. But there's a lot of herbs we can grow there. You just got to grow them in the right season, at the right time. David says parsley was considered a vegetable, not an herb, in Louisiana. And, you know, I do think that there is a things like peppers you might consider a fruit or a vegetable. That's fine, but it's also a great herb. Parsley is, you might consider an herb, but it's also an incredible vegetable. I use it in pesto all the time. And by the way, here's a great spring recipe, David. Pay attention. Listen, use chickweed and parsley. Delicious. Absolutely delicious. for a pesto. Mmm. Chickweed growing wild in your yard. Parsley is a great, great plant for the Gulf Coast and for all of Alabama. Remind me to talk about parsley more. There's so much to say about parsley. Basil is another herb. We call it an herb, but really I treat it like a vegetable, right? I use so much of it. I use it in pesto. It's used all the time. I use it about as much as I would use kale leaves, for example. It really is delicious. You don't have to cook it for it to be good, but it can be cooked if you put it in late. But it's a great vegetable, basil is, and you treat it like a vegetable here along the Gulf Coast. So there's kind of a fine line there between herbs and vegetables, as David points out. Andre, we've got a little bit of time. I'm listening. Tell me what your questions are.
Well, first I'd like to tell you that I really love your show, and it's extremely educational as well as entertaining. But the question I have, I live in Orange Beach, and my lot is mainly sand. And the runoff on the lot from the street comes onto the lot. So I want to put in a garden, but I want to know how I can do it above the ground.
Yeah, so here's the thing. You always need to add, you don't want to disconnect your garden from the hydrology of the soil too much. And the reason is that it becomes very difficult to grow. It's almost like growing things in a container. And that means you're going to have to change the soil a lot. It can be a problem. I usually most yards you can benefit from raising the soil level about 6 inches, and maybe as much as 12 inches, and that's going to be fine. Let's talk about the runoff from the road. It's probably going to seep in, and it's probably not going to be collected that much by the plants. I wouldn't worry about it too much, but one of the best ways to avoid the problems with runoff from the road is to make sure you add plenty of organic matter to your soil and raise it about 6 inches. Most of your root activity, listen, is going to be in the first 6 inches of soil. There's a little bit more in the next 12 inches, particularly in sandy soil, if there's plenty of oxygen. But if you raise your soil 6 to 12 inches with organic matter, you're going to be fine. The organic matter will also help a little bit to deactivate, if you will, some of the organic toxins that come from roadways that have to do with hydrocarbons and things like that. So I think you're going to be okay. Fortunately, we don't have lead in gasoline anymore, and that was one of the worst things that came from road runoff was just pure lead. And lead, you don't deactivate it. It just persists for a long time. But I think just a simple thing, don't raise it too much or you're going to have a real problem gardening, particularly in those sandy soils. Just 6 to 12 inches of pure organic matter. If I run out of time to tell you what organic matter means, you call me back next week. But you know what? Am I sort of giving you the kind of information you need?
Yes, you certainly have.
Yeah. And don't even, you know, it's 6 to 12 inches. You don't even need to line the beds. You know, people think, oh, well, what kind of timbers do I need? At 6 inches, you don't need any timbers at all. The organic matter is going to stay put. It's going to stay right where it is. You know, here's what I do. I'm going to try to say this as quickly as I can. Here's how I start. I go get a bag of leaves, and I just, every time I want to grow a tomato, I take one or two bags of leaves and just dump them there and let them molder down. And that's going to raise the soil level about 3 to 6 inches. Boom. That's all I do. And it's great. And those leaves make all the difference. You're going to need want to add a little bit of lime, and you're probably going to need to add a little bit of fertilizer, a little bit, not too much, in that soil because it's so sandy. But that's going to make all the difference in how that soil performs, and I don't think you're going to have any problems with road runoff being an issue. If there's any issue at all, if you're worried at all about road runoff, just don't grow root crops. which will be a little deeper and might have a little bit more in there. But I think you're going to be fine just raising it 6 to 12 inches.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
All right, Andre. Thank you. You know, if you raise soil too much, and I there are people who do it very successfully, but it does create problems. And I can just you want to raise it just a little bit, just a little bit. Boy, I'm glad we got to talk about the things we got to talk about today. It sometimes seems like we have really big problems, but boy, Ukraine's got big problems. Oh man, and I don't know how it comes out, but anything we can do to help that really helps, and I'm not going to try to prescribe the best means. That there are things we can do that can make things worse, even when we think about it, we're helping, but we should do all we can to help the people of Ukraine right now. There are many places like that. Syria was the same way. We didn't show the same sympathy in Syria. Afghanistan has got its problems now, but boy, Ukraine. We'll be back next week.
Have you ever seen peaches growing on a sweet potato vine? Have you ever seen peaches growing on a sweet potato vine?